Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, we're gearing up for fall.
We'll talk a little turf maintenance in the first segment when we discuss how we round out a baseball or softball season and how we're going to get prepared for a football and soccer season.
And on today's Out of the Park segment, we'll head out to the north side of the Windy City, Chicago, and have a look at all the changes taking place at the corner of Clark and Addison Street. That's where the 101-year-old Wrigley Field ballpark is getting a multi-phased facelift. But that's not the only change at the friendly confines. Find out more when we interview Roger Baird and Justin Spillman with the Chicago Cubs.
Then we'll finish up with a high-low segment and talk about the differences that you can have between maintaining a sand-based or a soil athletic field.
All that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, and I'm joined, as usual, with my partner in crime, Teresa Beyer. How are you this morning, Teresa?
What's happening?
You sound a little more relaxed than you have been in recent weeks.
Yeah, so I feel a little bit better.
That's good. Well, today we're going to get to talk about one of my favorite subjects, the Wrigley Field.
Whatever. Cleveland is way better at losing than the Cubbies are.
Well, that's true. They are better. The Cubs have been winning a lot more lately. But, you know, it was Wrigley Field that was my inspiration to want to become a major groundskeeper all those years ago back in the 70s and 80s.
Sucker.
And so I'm kind of excited. Yeah. Oh, okay. So your inspiration was better?
Well, I just had some bigoted high school coach try to tell me that baseball fields were for boys, not for girls, and I should go play with my dolls. And yeah, everybody should base their career on some bigoted dork, right?
Did you try out for the team, or?
I just wanted to be the team manager. They stopped letting me play baseball back when I was about 7 or 8.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. They were afraid because I was bigger than all the boys.
And they couldn't even have a female manager? Because it seems like when my son and daughter went through high school, all the managers of all the boys' sports were all female.
Ah, that's
so
funny.
What's the deal?
He was just a jerk.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah. I don't think he realized that the players on the team were my friends and that I'd been hanging out with most of them since we were 7 or 8 or before. And so I think he saw it as somebody, you know, a girl trying to get in there and get all flirty. And believe me, I wanted nothing to do with that with those guys. So it was never going to be a problem.
But that wasn't what inspired you to become get involved in turf in the turf industry, was it?
A little bit.
Was it really?
It's what inspired me to take a closer look at baseball. And
okay.
Yeah. And then when I looked at all of the job options, yeah, turf is really what spoke
to me. You mean like laundry and that kind of stuff? You decided you didn't want to do that part of the business. You
yeah. I wanted to be a baseball laundress.
Let's see. Well, do I want to do team laundry or do I want to clean the stands or do I want to take care of the field?
Yeah, that's what always makes me wonder about the clubhouse managers. You know, some of the stuff they get to clean up. It's like, really?
Fortunately, they get taken care of well.
That is true.
That's interesting. I didn't know that it was playing ball that actually got you, or being involved in the way that you were got you excited about sports turf.
Well, I had wanted to play ball and I had been kept from doing that, and they were like, "Oh, you can play softball, it's just as good." And while I will admit that softball is a very good sport, it's not baseball. It's a different game. It's different strategy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of similarities, but there's a ton of differences between the two, and I liked baseball.
So you figured to get even, you were going to be the person taking care of the field.
That's right. They were going to need me to play their silly little game.
you'd be totally in control of when they could step on that field.
Absolutely.
Well, let's jump into our first segment of the show. We're going to talk about turf maintenance on this segment, and you know, it's interestingly enough, we're going to talk about getting ready for fall. And today, outside where I am here, it's in the 60s. It's windy and it's cloudy. It's a typical fall day, in my opinion. It's a little early.
Get me excited.
This time in August, but I love this time of year, and the first breath of fall that I feel just gets me really, really pumped up. But you know, we're getting ready for fall ball at our little league complex. We start next Monday, and so my guys are out there doing the last bit of work. Actually, today they're working on finishing their renovations of the mound and home plate areas on each of the three fields. But I mean, they laid almost 10,000 square feet of sod over the past 4 weeks. We've overseeded, we aerified, all that kind of stuff, fertilized.
Do you only aerify in the fall, or do you aerify spring and fall?
Summer? Yeah, we'll try and get an aerification in the spring. You know, our schedule is so cram-packed.
Yeah,
on this field.
That's why I was wondering.
You know, I'm lucky to get two aerifications in a year, and one of them's going to be typically in April, which is a little early.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the only time in the spring I can get it.
Yeah, it's hit or miss around this part. Yeah,
yeah, and we don't start till late April. The last weekend in April is when we start playing games there, but we have practices the 3 weeks before that. So There's not a lot of time for us to do aerification in there. So our real major aerification time of all times is the last 2 weeks of July.
Do you run a... Wow.
Yeah, it's not... Not a pleasant time, but you know what? I've never had a negative impact from it on our fields. Now, that's because, first of all, we're a native soil.
Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, yeah. but you know what? We had perfect growing conditions all season this season until our regular season ended. Then, of course, the drought came in and all the other issues, heat and everything.
Yeah.
So we were doing it under some pretty nasty conditions,
yeah.
Especially the past 2 weeks with the heat and the humidity came in. You know, we flood these fields over those 5 weeks because they've been starved of water during a good chunk of the second half of the season.
Yeah.
And it's amazing the recuperation that occurs on those fields from doing that.
Well, what else can happen when you flood those fields, Paul?
What else? Let me tell you what happens when you combine flooding and fertilizer.
And warm weather?
And ryegrass. And warm weather. Because I got hit with pythium 2 nights ago.
Ouch.
And, so it was apparently it really only hit us on one field really badly. On all three fields,
well,
it was
good.
Only the infields that it occurred on. One field we really had almost nothing on. But another field we had a little bit of stuff on. But one of my 60-foot diamonds, there was lots of pythium in the foul territories and on the infield. Nothing in the outfield.
Well,
not
a
lot I could do, you know.
I knew we
had cooler weather coming in a month. I knew we had cooler weather coming in 24 hours. So
yeah.
it's not like I'm gonna, you know, I'm a little league level. I'm not gonna be able to spend the money to buy fungicides to apply to those things. So it's
okay.
That's what it is.
You know, and there's not a lot curatively that's recommended. I mean, if you're on a golf course and you're on a golf green, they say go ahead and hit it curatively just in case if you don't have a preventative down or if your preventative's about to run out. But you're really not hitting it curatively as you are trying to give a preventative shot to the grass that hadn't been hit by the pythium yet. And I've gone ahead and I'm going to include some links. I got a couple of really nice ones, one from NCSU, North Carolina State University, and another one from Purdue that have a really good rundown of pythium, because I know we're not the only ones in the nation that are kind of dealing with this. We got some in our front yard because we over-fertilized. Somebody over-fertilized our front yard. And somebody's not used to dealing with native soil. But, you know, that's okay. It's not his job. So, but it looks good otherwise.
I mean, you know, the thing is you can plan all you want to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the weather throws you for a loop. And, you know, our situation, what really did me in was two things. We had been watering like crazy over the past 3 weeks because we weren't getting any rain.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing I know, The night before last, we got an inch of rain. And then last night, we got another inch and a half of rain.
Yep.
On top of the heat and the humidity. And we had just fertilized just a day ago.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, because you see the rain coming and it's like, excellent. Let's get this fertilizer in so we can get it down into the root zone. Yeah.
Well, because next week with kids in the complex, it's a little harder for me to get the fertilizer down.
Yep.
Your schedule's tighter. You've got too many other things you got to worry about getting done. So it was the time. And that's. There are lots of groundskeepers out there who deal with that same situation. Ideally, you'd like to schedule things when it's culturally perfect.
Right.
But in most cases, as you know, that's not the case. You have to do it where you can, just like our aerification. I got to do it in July.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it's always worked for us. We aerify and we overseed, and I've got, you know, grass coming up the gazoo on those fields because of it, thank God. You know, that's just part of the nature of maintaining sports turf. You can't always follow the rules that they put out.
Well, and that's interesting because I was pulling up some information. I was looking for some maintenance schedules online. And I know that there are some good written publications, but I don't have them available to me, you know, right away. I know that Virginia Tech put one out, and I think Iowa State has put one out. I can't remember if Penn State has put one out as far as a larger written publication on turf maintenance, athletic field turf maintenance. You know, the guys at Virginia Tech put one out, a full on book, hardbound and everything like that. But online, there was a lot of generalized information. And we're going to include those links. One of the most generic ones I found was a really old one that Dr. Minner had put out. It was, you know, it was good information. I'm not laughing at it saying that it's bad information. I'm laughing at it because it's so generic. And it says that it's a generic program on there, but it doesn't give much as far as dates or anything like that. But
sure.
What I kept finding over and over is that when they did have a maintenance calendar for something that was a fall sport, even when they tried to get specific, they still kept it very general. And yeah, we know that we should fertilize this amount at this time ish, but it was almost like they didn't want to break it down because the specifics can change so much from field to field. And so what I would like to do is hear from any of our listeners that are preparing for football or soccer. What are you doing specifically? So let's start with cultivation because we were talking about that. Do you cultivate at all during the season? Because sometimes it's recommended in these athletic field maintenance calendars. But now, you and I were talking about,
Are you talking about for fall sports? Or are you
talking about for fall sports?
Yeah. So we're talking football, soccer,
right?
Tail end of baseball.
You missed that part. You were coughing. That's okay.
I did the cough switch.
Hey, everyone is glad you took the time to cough over there, not on mic. So that's good. But it's recommended in the fall. But I can't imagine covering up your field in a bunch of cores when you got a football game on Friday. Wow. Go Southern. I don't know where that came from.
Well, high school. High school's on Friday nights today.
I meant the way I said Friday.
Oh, I see.
Because exactly what it was. I was thinking about football, which made me think Southern.
But here's the deal. You get away from the colleges and you get away from the pros, and most of these people are now dealing with native soil fields.
Right.
So let's look at this.
So now you really got to get some coring done.
But if you core aerify that football field during the football season, and now suddenly you get a rain system that comes in.
Yep.
You got a mess. Because you've opened all those pores.
Yep.
They're going to load up with water.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about quickly destroying a field? You're better off keeping that field solid.
And allowing
that water to shed off. Now,
I guarantee, though, we've got somebody out there who'll swear by it.
Oh, I'm sure they will. They just haven't been caught yet.
Ha!
I think the better situation to do there would be something more of
solid tining.
Solid tining. Or maybe
needle tining on a native soil field might be difficult depending on the year.
Because if you've been through a drought, it's particularly hard. And that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when Pat was still taking care of
Santa Rome.
Memorial. Yeah. I'm sorry. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
was still taking care of Memorial Stadium when I was with the Orioles. He used to tell me that when Colts football played there, especially during baseball season, what they did to minimize damage to the field was they dried that football field out as dry as they could get it and kept the grass long. And that, of course, minimized the damage to the field. And
yeah, wear is much more prevalent when the ground and the turf is wet.
Right. And so that was a native soil field, of course, back then. Now, nowadays, the other thing to consider, if you're on a, let's shift to the college and pros. If you're on a sand-based field, you're already worried about anchoring of your turf because as soon as you learn, as soon as you lose the roots, you're in trouble because you got no other way to hold on to that turf. That's why people like Allen with the Packers, name escapes me all of a sudden. Allen Johnson with the Packers. He's got the DD Grassmaster system where you've got the fibers that are sewn into the turf.
That's so why people push Bermuda so far north.
Absolutely, because of the root system is so deep and so thick. Whereas in the bluegrass
or the stolons on the Bermuda,
So bottom line is, if you start core aerifying a sand football field during the football season, you're going to put yourself in trouble, in my opinion, because you're going to lose a good chunk of your anchoring of that turf.
Yeah.
And it's easier to destroy it. So, again, needle tining, I think, is going to be the way, because you do also risk the sealing off of that sand-based field, which can happen if you don't aerify over time.
Well, and then that was my other concern. My research was done on wear tolerance in Bermuda grasses and specifically football wear tolerance. So I did a lot of work or research and into the math, of 300-pound football players running around out there and the amount of pressure and the force and all of that. And so then the other part of me says, does a needle tine actually do any good? Are you actually winning enough from that that it's worth it, or should you just put it off until spring?
I'd
love to know what our football and soccer guys do about that. I know soccer's going to be different, but even though you got smaller players, they're running around there a lot more.
Yeah, and you do have concentrated areas of compaction, goal areas, and that kind of stuff that you do still have to worry about in soccer just as much as you do down the center of a football field.
Yep. Well, and so then that brings me to fertilization. And we'll talk more about this as we move into the high-low section, some of the differences between native versus sand-based fields. But I found some good sources. Interesting, I didn't find as many northern sources. So I've got NCSU, Kansas State, and then some really old ones. This was a joy for me to find, actually. Dr. A.J. Powell, who passed away recently, or semi-recently, a couple years ago, I found an entire page full of some of his old turf publications. And, they're old, but they're good. They're good. He's even got one in there for a polo field, which, go Kentucky. I love that. having studied there, I think that's brilliant. There is a lot of polo in Kentucky, which is just will blow your mind when you think about it. But he had a really good plan on there for overseeded Bermuda grass. We had mentioned that, moving Bermuda grass north for the footing. But even the specific plans are still very vague. There's a lot of vagaries about there. And I know why they're doing it, Paul, and I understand that. But at the same token, I wonder about some of the guys who don't have the benefit of going to turf school and where they're going to learn some of the specifics about, is it better to fertilize 7 days out, 10 days out, 14 days out before your big game, because you want the green flush, but then you also don't want too much flush because you're going to lose some of your wear and all of that. So I'd really like to hear from some of our listeners. What are some of your strategies? I mean, we don't need a specific, but we don't need you to break it down week by week by week. If you want to, that'd be awesome. Do you try to put out more potassium? Potassium is known now, and you won't see this as much in some of these old ones, especially because they're dealing with native soils. But potassium is now known to be a major contributor to wear tolerance, and you just don't see a lot of issues where they say apply more potassium. I'll tell you guys, even on a native soil field, that potassium does you a lot of good.
Yeah. I got into on sports fields applying potassium at almost a 1-to-1 ratio with nitrogen. The other thing is potassium is also...
We actually go 1.5 to 1.
Yeah.
On our sand.
The thing about potassium is just as mobile as nitrogen is.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's why, especially on sand-based fields, you absolutely have to do that or higher, like you say, because, a sand system everything just flies through there.
Oh, and yeah.
So you need the dense root mass in order to catch it while it's going through.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have much of a root mass, you're losing everything. It's going right through, and you know, you might as well just take the money and hand it over to me, basically.
Yeah. And you need that potassium to help move the nitrogen around in the plant. Absolutely. Give the plant all the nitrogen you want. If it can't move it, it can't use it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, on athletic fields, even native soil fields, I am of the camp of trying to get that nitrogen up at least 50% potassium to 1% nitrogen, but preferably higher.
Yeah.
That's from my experience over the years, I've found that tends to help the plant out much, much better.
And there's been some work with calcium and with magnesium and manganese, and we can go into that a little bit more in the high-low segment, but those are big on wear tolerance. And they've been taking some look at silicon as well, but it's been a little harder to pin down. The more micro the micronutrient, that doesn't mean it's less important. It just means the plant needs a little bit less of it. But the more micro the micronutrient, the harder it seems to be to pin down exactly when and how to use it to get the best benefit. But that's a whole different show.
That's a whole nother science section.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I almost turned it into a turf science segment. That would have ticked you off.
Thank God I evaded that. Well, I got more to say on that, but we can hang on for that until we get to that segment of the show.
Yep.
So with that, let's take a break, because my mind is starting to cringe from the thought of science. And go to a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back with our Out of the Park segment. The football seasons are kicking into gear, and Beacon has what you need to outfit your football and soccer fields for the fall season, be it team benches, goals, goalposts or goalpost padding, and flags. We also can design and supply soccer barrier and football end zone netting systems. When it comes to the field, we have the paints you'll need, along with the machines to stripe them. We can also supply hash mark, numerical, and custom logo stencils to help you with your field artwork. Finish your fields off with yard markers, pylons, or corner flags, first down chains, and turf and track protection for bench areas and running track crossover areas. Beacon Athletics is your one-stop shop for all things soccer and football. We're just as much a fan of these sports as we are of baseball and softball. Call Beacon's staff of experienced sports fans at 800-747-5985, and we'll get you set up and underway for fall. If you miss our normal sales hours, remember that our web store at www.beaconathletics.com is open 24/7, 365 days a year to take your orders and get you underway. And today's Out of the Park segment brings us to the friendly confines of Wrigley Field. The ballpark, which turned 100 years old last year, is in the midst of a multi-year, multi-phase renovation of the old ballpark that, when finished, will bring many modern amenities to the century-old yard. Changes have also occurred on the field as longtime head groundskeeper Roger Baird has moved up in the organization to assistant director of facilities, and his former on-field assistant Justin Spillman has moved into Roger's former position as head groundskeeper. Both of them are here today to speak with us about the changes going on the ballpark on the north side of Chicago. So a big Diamond Da Vinci welcome to Roger and Justin. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you here on the Diamond Da Vinci podcast.
Nice to be here.
Oh, in unison. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's like you practiced.
So Roger, you've taken a step up in the organization, up off the field into facilities. How long were you down in the groundskeeping area?
Well, I started here at Wrigley Field back in 1979.
Holy crap.
In 1995, I took over as the head groundskeeper here.
And, 95, you said?
Yes, 95. Yeah. So pretty much close to 20 years.
So 79, what did you start on the ground crew in 79, or were you in some other position at the park?
I was in facilities and ground crew, but it was in the early 80s. About 83 is when I actually got on the field and stayed on the field from 83 to 95, and had another head groundskeeper. His name also was Roger O'Connor before me.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in 95, he got ill and passed away, and the Chicago Cubs asked me to fill in for the rest of the season, and the rest is history.
Kind of lasted a little longer than that, huh?
Yeah, It was a sad note because Roger had a very friend and very highly respected man.
And Roger was a really great guy. I actually knew Roger and the other Roger, a tremendous person, as you are as well.
Thank you.
So you remember Luby Veal then?
Oh, absolutely. Worked many years with Luby. Luby was a very, very good man. Very nervous person on range situations, but he knew his stuff about ball fields, and me and Luby spend quite a bit of time together.
Aren't we all nervous when rain's around?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, that was a long delay. It was Luby who I had actually sent my resume to when I left turf school back in the early 80s to get a job out there at Wrigley. Anyways, I digress. So you've seen a heck of a lot of time there at Wrigley. What have been the big changes to you as you see it to Wrigley prior to this year, because a lot of things happened this year? Were there many changes between 79 and this year?
The park really has stayed pretty much the same. Obviously, the field that we did a major transaction in 2007. Right. We changed the field from a native field to an all sand based field with the underground drainage, new sprinkler system. Big beneficial, obviously, to me and the guys here at the field. And like I said, just perfect example is last night how much rain we took. And after the rain stopped, we were playing baseball a half hour later. And we probably dropped close to an inch and a half, 2 inches there real quick.
That's amazing.
Mm. Yeah, that's certainly much easier than what the old ballpark was like with the native soil, that's for sure.
Yes, and the big crown and
no
underground drainage. The only drainage I had was along the wall, so yes.
Wow.
Obviously, the players love it.
Did that park ever flood in the past?
We've had some flooding issues, yes, in years past. But like I said, with the underground drainage now, we got it's miles of piping underground. And knock on wood, it's done quite well in 8 years or 9 years here. It's been down for us. And obviously all the events and games and everything that we have going on out here.
All those years and all those events that, you know, is there anything that's really stuck out in your mind over those however many years that's been, that any event that really stuck out in your mind or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for me personally, I probably two of the favorite events I think we've ever had here. I really enjoyed the Winter Classic when we had the Winter Classic here on New Year's Day. I forget exactly how many years ago. And then actually when we did have a football game here, Northwestern against Illinois. That was something I really enjoyed because it was both of these events were after the season, so we have time to repair the field. Those were enjoyable. Those were the two most enjoyable events I've had.
Sure. When you started in 79, there was no football regularly going on at that point, was there?
No, in 79, no. The Bears, I believe, the last time they played here at Wrigley Field was 1971. You know, obviously they played here all the time.
Yeah.
And then they shifted over to Soldiers Field.
Yeah. Were there any ball players that you were especially fond of over your career? And they don't necessarily have to be. They don't necessarily have to be with the club, with the Cubs, even. that you dealt with.
Yeah, there's
time and time to
there's
your
a
job.
Few. There's a few players that, you know, became pretty good friends with me. Honestly, a person who's still very nice and comes around the park all the time and always says hello to me is Billy Williams. I'm really, really fond of. Lee Smith has always been a very good person. He was always tremendous with the guys in the ground crew, coming to room, spend time, a very down-to-earth person. And believe it or not, Greg Maddox also was another guy who would come in and spend a lot of time in the room and say hi to the guys, a real good person.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Billy was my childhood idol. And I got to meet him the first year I was in Major League Baseball because at the time in 85, he was the hitting coach for Oakland. And I felt like about a 5-year-old walking up and talking to him.
It's still a pleasure every day when me and Billy get to talk a little bit. It's a big pleasure when I get to actually physically talk with him.
Sure. So The transition occurred in this past off season, right? When you moved up and then Justin moved, right?
Right. I mean, obviously, like I said, I moved up to a role of like assistant director of facilities and grounds, and then like I said, Justin is, you know, running the field, and I'm just sort of overseeing. But Justin's doing obviously a fantastic job out there. So it's really nice. I mean, we talk and we spend three quarters of the day together still.
Yeah, well, that's a good
better
thing.
Boss, I tell you.
We're five feet
away from each other right now, and it's like that all day long, you know, with us passing each other.
And the fact that Roger's got so much history with the park, it's a godsend for you, you know, having somebody who knows everything about that park that's gone on over the past umpteen years and decades that it's nice to have somebody with that kind of wisdom close by. So if you're wondering about something, you got somebody who can tell you really quick what it's all about. Before I jump to Justin,
bouncing ideas off each other. So
yeah. So before I bounce to you, Justin, Roger, can you explain what your position involves right now?
Everything. Well, obviously, right now what's going on here, as everyone knows, there's major renovations being done here at Wrigley Field. Our bleachers are officially done, and it's amazing how it turned out, and there's a lot of construction going on the outside of the ballpark. So honestly, every single day, something new opens here, or we have to make a few adjustments. So that's really taking care of the stadium. Mm-hmm. And then also, like I said, I'm helping Justin as much as possible in the field. But like I said, sure. Justin's doing a great job. We have some off-site areas that we take care of. And me and Justin are probably going through, you know, 70 to 100 workers that we're responsible for. So
wow.
We're staying busy. We have quite a few shifts and staying quite busy. And it just... keeping my eyes open, it's amazing seeing the transformation, what's going on here at Wrigley Field. If anybody's ever been out here at Wrigley Field in the last year, you'd be shocked with all the changes that have gone on here.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about those changes in just a minute. Let me get to Justin and let's bend his ear a little bit. Justin, you started there a year ago this past spring, correct?
2013, mid-season.
Oh, 13. Okay, mid-season 13. Yeah. I thought it was last year. I'm sorry. That's been I would call that a meteoric rise.
It was nice. It was very nice. And Roger, I think, was an intricate part in getting me here with me being here for the field renovation in 07, working hand-in-hand by Roger's side. Really helped, I guess, getting me here.
So you were there for the renovation?
Yes. Yeah.
Really?
A lot of fun, and never thought in a million years I'd be back being a groundskeeper, but somehow it happened.
What? So, who were you working for, the contractor, or?
Yes. Yes.
You.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Interesting. I didn't know that. Because that was going to be my next question: What is your history in the groundskeeping industry?
I've been a part of building over 70 fields around the country, from major league, minor league, collegiate, independent ball. And a minor league groundskeeper all around the country, and from Altoona, Pennsylvania to Jupiter, Florida, West Tennessee, and then out to Arizona, where I came from before I came here.
That's some pretty widespread experience there across the country.
Yeah, that's always good
like
to have in your belt.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which company was it you were working for then?
Roger Bossard's company.
Oh, okay.
Called,
yeah, sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So. Okay. Were there any particular challenges then that you didn't expect when you came into Wrigley then? I mean, obviously being exposed to it from the construction side of it, you probably already knew some of the ins and outs.
The stadium itself, trying to get around and stuff, and Roger helped me with that. And some of the tendencies, the weather patterns, and then, you know, getting to know, I guess, the whole crew. And Roger sort of really, really helped me along with that, you know, eased me in. Started on July 15th, and we had two concerts on the 19th and 20th, so I was sort of burned into the fire.
Wow. Welcome to the big leagues.
Yeah.
So So
I think we resodded actually almost 30,000 square feet after those two concerts, too.
Wow. Boy.
That's really why he bought gin, in other words. He just needed an expert who could whip in a lot of sod in a hurry.
Yeah.
Are you native to Chicago, Justin?
Illinois, across the river from St. Louis. Initially got my start as an internship with the Cardinals at the old Busch Stadium.
Oh, really? Okay.
Huh. Yes.
Did you go to turf school?
I did. I have dual degree in turf grass management and agronomy for turf and soils from Lewis and Clark in Godfrey, Illinois.
Oh, cool. Very good. That's great. So the question would be, being at Wrigley, are you a day game lover or a night game lover?
Mostly day. I've got a family now with two kids. I'd like to sit down to dinner with them every evening. So. Yeah. You know how that is, Paul.
I would have killed for as many day games as you guys get.
They're going away, though. I tell you, the business specials are going away. You know.
How many day games do you guys have there now a year?
It's about maybe half now.
Yeah, we're right around 40 night games. We're up to about almost 40 night games now, and then with the 40 day games, I would say out of those 40, 20 of them are like 305 games.
Sure.
Mm. So 120s are becoming very rare.
That's sad because, you know, I grew up here in Madison, of course, and I, as a teenager, I would drive down several times a year to watch the Cub games, and this is, of course, back in the days before lights, and that was the beauty of it. Wrigley, to me, in my opinion, is the most beautiful in the daytime with the sun shining and the breeze blowing the ivy leaves around. That's just mm-hmm. my personal opinion. And you know, I think a lot of people, one of the reasons they love Wrigley is for that very reason. It's just, I can remember the first time I walked into that ballpark as a kid, and I came up through the vomitory and you know, you open up to this beautiful field with the ivy out there and the sun shining. It's like, oh my God. This is the way baseball should be. And I would have loved to have had as many day games as you guys had, just for the fact of I'd get actually some more sleep during my
time.
The worst
is a night game leading into a day game the next day.
Oh, you don't have to tell me.
About 3 hours sleep a night.
Do you live very far? Do you commute very far from the field?
I'm actually an hour away over in Indiana. I live in Indiana.
So tough for you guys in the larger markets.
More bang for the buck over there and less taxes, I guess. So.
Yeah,
yeah, but you know, you've got to drive when you're most tired, which is really tough.
Sure. Anything for the family, though.
Yeah.
But the one thing that at least when I was in Baltimore, most of the time I found myself driving into or out of work at the off-peak hours of traffic.
Yes.
You know, it was rare when I actually had to go in during rush hour time. And I assume that's what you guys have in the same situation for the most part.
I agree. Sometimes the 120 games during the week will mess you up with some traffic because you're getting out of here, you know, roughly 5:30.
In the evening. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, traffic's a bear. So.
What? Chicago has bad traffic? You're kidding.
There wasn't much traffic last night.
No, I didn't get home till 3 in the morning, yes. So.
Yeah. Oh, my. Oh, so you went all the way home last night?
I did. Even though
you had an hour. Wow.
Yeah, wow, like Raj said earlier, it's better off to sleep in your bed for at least 2 hours rather than laying on, you know, a cot or something here at the stadium.
Well, and
hopefully
I can,
with the renovations, I'll get a Murphy bed here to pull it out of my, you know, pull out of the wall.
There you go. That's what every grounds crew office needs is a Murphy bed. I hadn't thought about that. That's brilliant.
That's great.
I had a couch in my office for that exact reason, so that the one or two times a year that I had to sleep there, I had someplace to sleep. But the problem was, you know, in my office, I had a window right onto the field, and you know, the blowers went all night long. And
yeah, it's the exact same thing we have here. Obviously.
It's amazing how it penetrates
the
all the
crew and the noise. It's yes. very tough to sleep.
I'm surprised the neighborhood allows you guys to clean at night, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
With blowers, at least, with the blowers.
Yeah, but, I mean, they do use the blowers like only for about an hour or so when they
get
in. And then it's mainly all manual sweeping, you know, doing the rest.
After that, sure.
Now, Roger, I remember your office. Is it still in the same place, tucked way, way back? You're kind of, you don't have an easy access to the field, even though you're kind of close to the field. Is that right?
No, we're in the far left field corner, right by the left field foul pole.
Oh, okay.
And so, I mean, access to the field is pretty. We don't have a window like what Paul had, but
no, yeah,
that's coming.
We're about maybe 20 feet.
Okay, that's good. I remember thinking it was really tucked back in there, so I'm glad to hear that instead.
Yeah, and then like I said, we're still in our place, same room we've been in for quite a while, but over the next few years, we may get possibly a new area. We're still filling up. We're in the process of that.
In the design stage of that part of it, as in?
Yeah, that part of it, yeah. It's a few years down the road.
Well, other than a Murphy bed, what do you guys think is essential for an office?
A TV for weather.
Yeah.
And a computer, you know.
Yeah.
And a little fridge with lots of water in it.
You guys don't have a computer in your office?
Oh, yeah, we do. Oh, yeah. We do. And then we got a nice couple big screen TVs, too. But, I mean, that's just essential.
Yeah, absolutely.
I always thought we needed washer and dryers.
We've got those.
We have that.
Nice.
It's a load a day, it seems like.
Exactly.
Well, not after last night. It's probably a couple loads.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, after a rain day. Yeah.
So let's talk about real quick, if you would, Roger, what has happened over the past year in construction and what the next couple years plans are, because this is a multi-phase project. I forget what the cost is of this or what the estimated cost is. You know, obviously there's still a lot of design work going on some of these phases. When is this expected to end? What are the things we have to look forward to coming up? Some of this fans aren't even going to see, like the clubhouses and things like that. But if you could tell our listeners everything that's going on here.
Well, I mean, like I said, we just finished up our bleachers, as I said earlier, with we got the giant jumbotron that was added, extra seats out in the bleachers, right field. We got a jumbotron out in right field, a smaller version one, but you know, we still got the manual scoreboard in center. And the amenities down below, brand new concession stands, restrooms. Like I said, our bleacher is really turned out gorgeous. And right now, just to the west of the ballpark, connected to the ballpark, there's doing some major digging out there. It's going to be called our plaza. In fact, that is where the new Cubs clubhouse is going to be located. It'll be underground. As we all know, Wrigley Field here been here for 100 years. Our clubhouses are quite small that we have now, but the brand new clubhouse, when it's done, it's going to be the second largest in baseball.
In the smallest ballpark, isn't that amazing? Second largest in the smallest ballpark.
But it's going to be all underground underneath the plaza, and then we're having a brand new. I think it's going to be a 6-story building with brand new front offices. With some restaurants, retail, and then he's going to have a plaza out there. And we're going to have grass out there and benches from farmer's market days to what do we have there?
Movie nights, maybe clinics, actually, baseball, football, soccer. It just depends.
Not on the field, not on your field, but out in the plaza.
Plaza
there, right?
Field, yeah. Yeah.
Right. Correct, yes. That's a very nice spot for it.
Yeah, and then, you got that right.
And then the next stage is they're going to be starting possibly this fall's hotel right across the street is also going to be started. We should be done within, they're hoping, within 2 years.
Which street are we talking about here?
It'll be directly on Clark Street, right at the corner of Clark and...
Addison?
Addison.
Okay. Okay.
Who's going to be in charge of the turf outside of the field? Is that going to be you, Roger, or is that going to be Justin?
Me and Justin are going to flip coin.
Hey, if I were you, Roger, I'd pull rank and say, I'm sorry, buddy, but you're taking care of
it. You know, I've always found there's nothing harder than trying to take care of a second field when you're focused on your primary field.
I mean, obviously, we're going to have quite a bit of pedestrians out there. It's going to be a beautiful neighborhood thing. That's what it's really all about. You know, it's for the neighborhood, you know, and
yep.
Have some special events, what have you, maybe even possibly, who knows, maybe even an ice skating rink in the winter and, you know, a few other things.
You know, I hate to sound old-fashioned, but I'm hoping that they don't destroy too much of the ambiance of the old look of the ballpark on the outside. Because even, you know, you got the outfield wall and the ivy inside. But on the outside, there's something about the look of that ballpark that makes it look old, which makes it in my opinion, the friendly part of it. You know, it's the place that's always been there.
I agree with you, but and I got to tell you, the Rickett family, they are take extra attention to what you just talked about. They are keeping the look of Wrigley Field. They're actually good. I mean, it's gonna be a beautiful looking rendition. It's gonna be Wrigley Field. It's not gonna change.
Yeah,
they're being really extra careful on that.
As you, oh, and I'm, you and came I'm sure out there
and saw the, you see the bleacher walls and all that on the outside. It's mm-hmm. just how it was.
Great, that's fabulous. I can't wait to get down there to see it. I'm hoping to take some pictures and put them up on the on our website with the broadcast when we release this next week. But so now, is anything being done in the seating bowl? And obviously, the bleachers have been done, but on the other permanent area of the seating bowl, is anything being done in those areas at all?
As of right now, no. But in phases down the road, probably a couple of years down, yeah, we're going to have an all new concrete and, you know, obviously brand new seats and all new concessions and restrooms. Yep. We're adding quite a few more restrooms have already been added, and even, you know, more are going to be going in. And, you know, just it's time for an update here at the ballpark.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the last time I was there, was it last year? Yeah, it was last year for the 100th, the game that had the big 100th anniversary celebration. I was there and I'll never forget it, because I remember seeing you guys water the infield and then this cloud of steam coming off an infield, which I had never seen that before. It was kind of cool. But for that 100th anniversary game, I was sitting in the bleachers and I remember watching the game and a play happened, and I'm looking, you know, just instinctively you start looking for the replay board, you know, and I was looking around, I was like, oh, wait a minute. That's right. We're at Wrigley. There's no replay board. So
now we do have that.
Now you've got it. But, you know, and I'm kind of torn with that, Roger, because in a way I'm glad you have it, but in a way I loved it the old way. So it'll be interesting to see how I feel about it when I sit in the seats the next time I visit there. And you know, see what it feels like. But I'm sure for the most part, I think all the fans really appreciate having that in there, because it's just something that you just expect in a park now.
Like I said, I at first, you know, there was some judgment, but I mean, I have not heard anything negative at all about that now.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I know the fans. Whatever, I was back in April, or I think it was in May. Our Chicago Blackhawks were, you know, going for a Stanley Cup, and we had a rain delay. And they were able to put the Hawk game up on the jumbo.
Oh yeah!
You talk about a crowd cheering. So like I said, I have not really heard anything bad about it. I think they made it the right size, and just the way it's built, it almost feels like it's part of the, you know, it's always been here.
Well, I hope that you guys eventually get new groundskeeping facilities out of it. Now I know you used to have storage area under the bleachers there. Did you get that back after the bleachers were built?
Yes. Actually, we've gotten quite a few new areas under there. So
good.
We're doing better. We're doing better than what we had, yes.
Yeah. Well, we all look forward to seeing the changes as they occur at Wrigley, and we appreciate you guys both coming on for the show today. Roger, have you warned Justin about the NASCAR carbon that they're going to have on the field later this fall?
like me and Justin always talk, you know, I unfortunately said I've got a lot of gray hairs, but I've noticed Justin get a few over the last couple of years. I said, welcome to the club.
It's just beginning. But pretty soon, Justin, you'll be just like me where you've lost a lot of it.
I don't know. I got pretty dense hair follicles, I tell you. Yeah.
So. Well, you're lucky, because I lost most of mine in that job position. But, guys, thanks a lot. We really appreciate you taking time off for a few minutes off the field to come and talk to us. And like I said, I hope to get down there and get some pictures taken of what's been done and what's going on. And we'll throw those up on the website when we get the show done here. Have a great rest of the season. And speaking as a Cub fan, I hope like hell you're in the playoffs this fall, because I can't wait to see you guys in the playoffs again. And of course, it's always more fun working at a ballpark when you're in the playoffs than when you're 20 or 30 games out, like I experienced a couple times with the Orioles. There's a big difference in motivation for work.
Yes, Paul, it's a very exciting year so far, and we sure hope, like you said, we do make the playoffs this year. The team is definitely very exciting to watch here, and yep. Like I said, the workers, everybody is excited, and you know, me and Justin just keep looking at each other and saying, is it going to happen? Is it going to happen?
But you never say anything. You
that's just, right. Don't jinx it.
We just give a look.
That's right.
Well, thanks for having us, Paul. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much, Justin and Roger. Have a great day.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll see you.
Any good Diamond Da Vinci knows that late summer and fall are the best time to get your ball fields ready for next season. Take advantage of the normally dry fall weather to prepare your field and facility so it's close to opening day ready by the time winter sets in. Avoid those wet spring conditions that can back you up against an opening day deadline. Here at Beacon Athletics, we're ready for your fall projects, be it mound and home plate renovations, infield skin overhauls, or larger projects like new net backstops, outdoor batting cages, dugouts, padding, or other facility amenities. Beacon has the products and the expertise to guide you through product and design choices. We'll work to help you get the best you can for the budget you have to spend on the project. Call us at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985, where our staff of experts are waiting to help you prepare for next season right now. Don't put off till tomorrow what you can do today. Do it now to make your spring easier.
So for today's high-low segment, we thought we should talk about some of the differences between a soil-based system and a sand-based system, because Wrigley has recently moved from, as we were talking about in our interview, from the soil to the sand base. And we are talking about a full sand-based root zone, sand caps and the Cambridge system. If you know what those are, we'll talk about those in a whole different show. That's a whole interesting topic, I think. But talking sand versus talking soil, we usually put that in the thought pattern of high versus low, because you will see a lot more of the high budget fields going with a sand base and the low budget fields going with the soil base, because in the initial output of money, it's a lot cheaper. And they each have their own little specifics, and they have some pros and some cons. And I thought we should go through that today, and some of the differences between them. The biggest difference is their physical properties and what actually makes up the soil itself. How big are the little tiny bits and pieces of that soil? And so the first thing you do if you get any field is you get your specs done. You get your soil specs done, so you kind of know what you're working with, how much sand you have versus how much of the other pieces. And so depending on what you have is how your water and how your nutrition will flow through there or be held in there. Paul, you know a lot about soil physics. Do you want to go into a little bit of the physics behind that? And we don't want to turn this into a turf science segment. God
that's
forbid.
Right. So I'm going to try not to sound too sciencey, because I leave that to the science chick on the show. But you're right. The soils play a part in the mobility of the water through the profile and also through the nutrient holding capacity, which, you know, typically we'll use the CEC or the cation exchange capacity to use it as the measure of how well that soil is going to hold it. And typically a sand-based field is going to have a very low CEC, typically like 3 or lower, which isn't very strong.
Yeah.
So typically a sand-based soil is a very sterile, what I call a sterile environment, and you have to keep feeding it little bits at a time because it goes whoop, right through that soil. It can't hang on to it. Whereas a native soil field, because of the clay particles, because of the silt particles, which have a higher capacity to hold on to the cations and exchange them, they can. You don't have to fertilize them typically as frequently. You don't have to apply as many micronutrients. They hold on to the nutrients longer, so it takes longer for them to move through the soil via water, that kind of thing. The same thing with moisture. Sand particles are the biggest of this, what we call the soil separates, the different particle sizes of soil. They also create the largest pore spaces. So the reason why sand-based fields drain so well is because they have lots of large pore space, and gravity can get up there and suck that water right down. But a native soil field...
I'm enjoying all of your sound effects today.
Well, I don't have a chalkboard or a whiteboard to show people, so I have to do something. The native soil fields, of course, have silt, which is the next smallest size particle below sand. and then the smallest particles, clay, in the soils, varying levels of each of those. And it, because everything varies with from one soil to the next, what happens on your field on one side of the street could be completely different from what happens on a field on the other side of the street, depending on what the soils are made up of.
Well, and heck, if you're working on true native soil, you could have a difference from one side of your field to the next.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
God love you if you do.
Depending on what's happened when they graded the location. And, you know, if they did it right, they went down to the subsoil, graded that, and then graded your field on top of that, mm-hmm. with the better topsoil. So sand-based soils, again, because they have a large pore space, because there's very little silt and almost no clay in those materials, the gravity can get there and pull that water down more quickly. It can. It's very hard for sand-based soil to wick water up towards the plant. And most of the time, it's going to be going down. Native soil fields, water will move downward much more slowly, mm-hmm. because of the smaller pore space and because of the wicking ability of clay and some silt to be able to pull water up from down below. So those are kind of the differences between the sand and the silt, without getting too much more science-y involved.
Oh, no, You've shown us your big old brain today, Paul. Yeah, it's too late now.
Now, the common mistake that was made when I was in Major League Baseball in the 80s, and you were starting to see a lot of Major League Baseball fields turning from native soil fields to sand-based fields, there were many really good groundskeepers, myself included,
who made
lots of mistakes in those early days. And yep. The most common mistake was taking a sand-based field, and they something would happen, and they'd have to strip off the original sod that was put in by the contractors when they built it, and they would come back in with a sod that was grown on a mineral soil. It wasn't a sand-based sod. So now you had a layer of a very fine particle soil on top of a coarser particle soil, which is sand. And soil physics tell you that if you put a fine textured soil on top of a coarse textured soil, the water cannot move through that fine textured soil layer until it is totally saturated.
That's the perched water table effect. And we actually do that on purpose when we look at the major drainage, 8 to 12 inches down.
Now, correct, yeah. But not at the surface.
Not at the surface. That kind of defeats the purpose.
Not only does it affect drainage, but it can also affect the rooting.
Yes.
The rooting will stay at the surface. Why? Because that's where the water is, and the roots are going to go where the water is. Well, if you're perching the water table, right? If you're perching the water table and you're holding that water up at the surface, your roots don't go anywhere. So subsequently, what was happening, these guys, like in football, if they made that mistake, there was absolutely no footing because the roots never grabbed hold into the sand.
Yep.
So they were blowing out fields. You know, in baseball, you'd see a player make a step in the outfield, on a dead run trying to catch a ball, and the grass go out from underneath of them. It could be because they had used some native soil sod on there. But, now, 20, 30 years later, since we've made this change, everybody knows, mm-hmm. and they use the right types of sod, either a washed sod or a sod that's been grown on sand, those kind of things, so that you don't get that problem in there. But that was a real common problem with some of the best groundskeepers I've ever known made those mistakes. It was just a common mistake made early on.
Well, and the pros who have the money, and the Twins are a good example of this, will go out of their way to get a matching soil profile.
Absolutely.
Larry trucks in from Colorado. Not every time he resods, but his major resodding events and the ones where he needs it to last and he needs it to count, those get trucked in all the way from Colorado because that's where the soil profile matches.
Right, and we had a sand-based sod farm that we had found on the eastern shore of Maryland when we were looking for a place to grow our sod for Oriole Park in the initial construction. We toured all over the place, up and down the Mid-Atlantic seaboard there, all the sand-based sod farms close to the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, and we found one in lower southern Maryland, on the eastern shore, rather, I'm sorry, that had almost the perfect sizing of sand that was going to be in our field, and that's what
good
you want
family
to find.
Too.
You want to find you want to find something that's really closely matches your sand particle size distribution So you don't have any of that, what we call interface, where you put two different soils together and they don't match up well, and suddenly you're getting a situation where the roots won't jump through that interface into the soil beneath it. So,
well, which isn't to say that if you have a lower budget that there's nothing you can do. You know, I think you've got a couple of different options. Paul, stop me if you think you've got a better idea or if you know something different.
Stop. I'm just kidding.
I'm going to take my podcast. I'm going to go home. but so, you know, you can look to stretch your money and see if you can find something nearby with as close of a profile as possible. They will have their own soil profiles. You need to talk to that sod farm and have them produce that for you. They will have that information, or they should be able to provide that information if they don't have it. Although most of the really good sod farms will have that. The other thing that you can do is get it as close as possible to what you have, but also you can do top dressing and you can do major core aerification. But this is a lot of core aerification, more than you would think. It's as often as possible with top dressing afterwards to help fill in those gaps and to help create that interface, to help punch through that interface and give those roots more of an option to dive down. But it is a, you know, it's a lot of work, but if you already own the aerifier, it's just you're paying for the time to get it done rather than paying to ship it in from Colorado or New Jersey or, you know, the Eastern Shore.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, when we talk about how it's, you can't, you should never put mineral sod on top of
mineral
a sand-based
sod.
Field.
Yep.
Yeah, mineral soil sod on top of a sand-based field. The opposite, however, works fine. If you have a sod that's grown on sand base and you've got a native soil field that you need to lay the sod on, you can, that's perfectly fine, because now you've taken and switched the things where you've got the coarse material, the coarse sand on top and the finer soils on the bottom. Water will go right through that coarse sand. Because the pore space is big, it can't hold on to that water and gravity pulls it down. Again, if you take that and flip it so that the finer textured soil is on top and the coarser textured soil is on the bottom, that's when you're going to perch that water table. And that's what you want to avoid, because that's when all the problems start snowballing on you on your field.
If you really want to have a fun time, ask an engineer who's familiar with water systems to explain why that works. And it takes about 2 hours. I lived with one of those engineers. She was one of my best friends through college. And it's a fascinating discussion. You'll fall asleep about halfway through it, but it's still cool.
Okay.
Oh, they go into the head of the water and the flow of gravity. It's brilliant the way they can do that. Well, okay. So talking about the water movement, one thing I want to bring up, we are going to link, there's another piece that AJ Powell from the University of Kentucky put together, and I just love him to death, this man. So it's titled Water, the Boondoggle for Native Soil Sports Fields. It takes somebody from Kentucky to use the word boondoggle correctly in a sentence. But it actually is a really nice narrative on how we can look at managing water on a native soil system. It's from 2007, that'd be great, 2007. And he's got some, I think, some good information on there. It's basic stuff, but he goes into a lot of detail when he can. One of the things he talks about in it is the crown of the field. When we're talking about native soil fields, that crown is really of big importance. And Paul, you and I have talked about this. You said the number one problem is putting, you know, the mineral soil sod on top of the sand base. But you also have mentioned in the past, you've seen a lot of trouble with people forgetting or intentionally leaving out any sort of crown on that field when they switch over to sand, because they're expecting to be able to take hurricane levels of water through that soil. And so they think, don't need a crown. It's just going to all rush right through. It says I've got 20 inches per hour.
And where that becomes a problem if you don't put a crown in is two things. First of all, it's like you say, you get a 5-inch rainfall, let's say, in a matter of 5 or 10 minutes. When that field's brand new, it'll take that pretty good.
Yep.
But give that field a year or two of life.
Yep.
It's a whole different story. It's not going to drain as fast.
Now you got roots in the way.
And so you always, on a sand-based field, should put some crown on there. You don't have to go to the extreme of the 1% or 1.5% slope that you might have in the past. But the fastest way to move water off an infield in most cases is by surface drain, by surface drainage and positive surface grade. Sand-based fields are a little bit of an exception because they can take water a lot faster, but even those will seal up over time, and you have to have a secondary way of moving that water off. And if you take that field and make it flat, it's not going to move. The other thing is, if you use tarps, you definitely want a crown on that field, because if you have a flat field and you put a tarp on that field, that tarp's going to hold a hell of a lot more water, and that's a lot more that your guys are going to have to manually move by pulling that tarp than if you were to have a crown on it, and that most of that water on the top of that tarp is going to roll off, so there's not that much water left on there. So that's the other reason. And, you know, there have been a lot of guys in pro sports who have decided to go with flat fields.
Mm-hmm. And it looks real pretty when you walk on them.
It's great. A flat field is awesome, but the problem is there are times when you've got to have that crown or a portion of that crown to move water off the tarps or to handle a really massive rainfall. So that's just my two cents worth in that.
Yeah. And that crown is hard to maintain when you're, you know, when, especially talking about a high-low segment like that. You know, one of the things I think, and I saw this a lot when I was doing my little stint in the construction biz, you don't see the crown when you're used to being on it, and so you forget to maintain that crown. Oh, and we have lost Paul, so we are going to pause.
No, Paul's here.
Paul's here. We just lost his visual. Okay, well, you guys don't need the visual. All right. Well, we'll cut that out. Well, so one of the... we'll start over. Okay. So one of the things I saw a lot when I did a quick stint in the construction side of things was that it's really hard for a locality to remember to maintain that crown. It gets worn down over time through cultivation, through wear, through all kinds of different things. Paul, do you have any experience with crown maintenance from a low or high budget end, either one?
We're talking about teeth, or are we talking about fields here?
Uh-huh, teeth. This is the teeth podcast. And next week, we're going to talk about root canals.
I've had those too. Well, certainly with baseball, from the baseball standpoint, you know, the where you have the biggest problem with crown management is on a softball field or a totally skinned infield, because your crown starts typically at the center of the field where the pitching rubbers are, and everything moves away, and that crown is totally exposed. So you get heavy rains, it's going to move the dirt. You can't physically see it, but it's moving.
You drag it wrong, you move the dirt the wrong way.
That's the other thing, is you drag it wrong and you're moving dirt the wrong way. So the groundskeeper's job is to constantly battle Mother Nature and their crew and his or her crew from improperly dragging, and keep bringing soil back up to that crown, because you know it's constantly moving. So it's a constant, you know, flow of material. It's moving down by Mother Nature, and you're bringing it back up to the top. Yeah. And you'll never stop the degradation of that crown happening, but you can certainly slow it down.
Yeah.
Now, with baseball fields and softball fields, that's typically the crown, the fight that you're going to have. With football fields, certainly the crown normally will run
from 20s.
Yeah, it'll run from your from goalpost to goalpost.
Yeah.
Is your high point. So but that's where most of the activity is, between the hash marks.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Actually, yeah, hashes in the 20s or hashes in the 40s, depending on the way your team plays. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what you have to do is build in some way in a schedule of every X number of years, you need to strip down that center part and reestablish that crown.
And pay somebody who has the equipment to do that properly.
Don't bring in some guy who happens to have a bobcat who can
I do it
down.
By sight.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
you need
lasers.
Experienced sports field contractors to do that work.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. And that's actually the quickest way to waste money, is to get somebody in who doesn't have experience doing grading, who does not have a lot of good references for their grading, whose grading is only involved in road building. Or construction sites. You want somebody who has
tennis
done,
courts or parking lots.
Yeah, somebody who has done specifically athletic field. It's worth paying the extra money for that. It will pay off. You will not have to renovate your crown again for another 5 to 10 years instead of having to do it 3 years later. So, yeah. Well, we would love to talk about nutrition, but I think we're going to have to save that for another show, and that's fine. I've got a ton to say about nutrition. I know you're shocked about that.
I just eat my vitamin fortified Chex every morning, and that takes care of my nutrition. So,
dude.
Okay. I think it's time to move on.
Yep. Hey, did we get any email?
We've been flooded with email.
Yay!
But I just want to read one. It's from one of our bigger fans, Andy Oman, from the McLean County Pony Baseball in Illinois. And he writes, I just listened to the podcast where Paul turned his ballpark around. It's frightening how familiar my story is to yours. Everything from installing fence cap and people thinking you've done tremendous work to blowing people away with pregame prep during tournaments with a crew of 5 to 6 guys.
That's awesome.
Awesome podcast. Andy's done basically the same thing down there. He went from barely having any grass on his outfield to having thick, lush grass and mowing and striping with real mowers.
That's awesome.
Changing his clay in his mound and home plate from pond clay to the DuraEdge product. And he's still improving, and he says he's gotten the exact same effect from their members and people and how excited they've gotten, and they give him more money to do more things, and that's how it works, you know.
Yeah.
When people see the results, they don't blink an eye at giving more money or paying a higher registration or whatever it is. Yep. So
and
that was a neat piece of mail.
And for encouragement to some of our other listeners, Andy does this as a second gig, and he doesn't get paid for it. He does this all volunteer, and his staff, people who help him, quote unquote staff, are all volunteer as well. So you know, this is the type of work that you can get done even if you're not a quote unquote professional groundskeeper. You know, it's all about the determination and the desire, I think. So, which is, yeah, I guess is true of anything.
He's exchanged pictures with us a couple times on our podcast email site, and he's got some really nice fields. He showed us to them when they weren't so nice under flooding and things like that. So mm-hmm. He's done a real bang up job down there. But yep, that's the kind of feedback we look for from our listeners, and we'd love to see that from you folks. So keep them coming. Aside from that, let me pull the old book from the library and tell you folks that puts this show in the books. So be sure to tune in next time to the Diamond Adventures for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is it's all free because, you know, the exchange between Teresa and I is just phenomenal.
It's not worth your money.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
Our official webpage for the show can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find our show notes, which will include any of the links that we've talked about, like today, or some photos. Paul's going to have some photos of the Cubs visit that he's going to make. He'll have that up to go along with our interview today. We also have our pictures and bios up there if you're curious to learn more about who you're listening to, if you're a first-time listener. And we also throw up some bonus material from time to time. Godzilla picture, still my favorite.
We'd love to hear from you, just like Andy Oman has written to us and countless others. You can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your comments or questions on our show, good or bad. And if you've got show ideas, send them along to us as well. We'd love to hear them.
And if by chance you're a Twitter follower, our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's @DiamondDaVincis. Not crazy active there, but we like to share some different interesting links and tell you more about the show prep.
And the Diamond DaVincis podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I say bye-bye.
Adios.